Is school choice a good thing for families and children? Will it improve education outcomes, or will it hurt our public schools? I am Richard Nelson, host of The Commonwealth Matters. Amendment 2 is on the Kentucky ballot on November the 5th, and it would open up the opportunity of school choice to parents across the Commonwealth, but there's strong opposition. Joining us to talk further is Dr. Gary Houchens, a professor of education administration and director of educational leadership, the doctoral program at Western Kentucky University. Dr. Houchens is a former state school board member, a public school teacher, principal, and he's currently on the board of EdChoice Kentucky and also a scholar with the Bluegrass Institute. Gary, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Richard. Always great to be with you.
Let's start with the language of the Amendment 2 that's on the ballot November the 5th. A lot of people are just learning right now that there's a constitutional amendment that addresses the issue of school choice in Kentucky. And this is what it says: to give parents choices in educational opportunities for their children, are you in favor of enabling the Kentucky General Assembly to provide financial support for the education costs of students in kindergarten through 12th grade who are outside the system of common public schools by amending the Constitution of Kentucky as stated below? And this is what it says. It is proposed that a new section be added to the Constitution of Kentucky to read as follows: the General Assembly may provide financial support for the education of students outside the system of common schools. And then it goes into statute references there in relation to the constitutional amendment. Gary, that is the long and the short of it. Pretty clear in that it opens the possibility for school choice in Kentucky. As it is, school choice is not allowed because of a state Supreme Court ruling a little over a year, year and a half ago, that said, look, if there's going to be any form of school choice, whether it's charter schools, whether it's educational opportunity accounts, any kind of choice whatsoever, the Constitution needs to be amended. Now here we are. So, Gary, we'll start with this. What is the impetus of offering choice to students, to parents who want an alternative to public schools for their children? What's the rationale behind it?
Well, I think we recognize in this state that education is a public good and that it's worthy of public investment and public support. But choosing a school for your child is one of the most individual and personal choices that a parent ever makes. And the question is, who is in the best position to decide what kind of learning environment is best for any given child? And most Kentuckians believe that that's parents themselves. The problem is that there are a great many families in the state who lack the resources to exercise education options. Affluent families do, in fact, have school choice in the state, and they exercise that every day when they buy a home in the neighborhood with the best schools, or they send their child across district lines to attend a different public school, or they afford private school tuition. The problem is that there are a great many families who do not have the means to do that. And what Amendment 2 does is simply say that the state constitution does not prohibit the legislature from considering programs that would empower parents of all income levels with the same kinds of educational choices that affluent families enjoy every day.
Gary, how many states across the country have some kind of school choice program?
Virtually every single state in the United States. When you look at a map of the country, Kentucky and North Dakota are alone in terms of denying families education options. Every state that borders us has one or more school choice options. And the public schools in those states are doing every bit as well, if not better, than Kentucky's, which proves that one of the arguments that school choice and Amendment 2 would somehow destroy public education is simply not true based on the experience of other states.
Gary, education outcomes in the Commonwealth of Kentucky have not been stellar in over really several years. According to the latest NAEP, the National Assessment of Educational Progress, I believe is what it's called, fourth graders in the Commonwealth of Kentucky are performing at 47% proficiency in areas of reading, and they are 43% proficient in math. Is that correct?
That's right. Yeah, it's essentially less than half of our fourth graders in this state are performing at grade level in the core subject areas. And, you know, there are a lot of reasons for that, but certainly no one in the state should be satisfied with our educational outcomes.
Why isn't there more concern? That should be headline news in the major news publications across the state, major TV outlets. Now, maybe it was. I might have missed it. It doesn't seem to be an area of concern where there's urgency, at least for some people, because you have public school teachers and the public school establishment saying they're not really focusing on that. They're not apparently or seemingly concerned about education outcomes. And look, if we are not educating our kids at the grade school level, they're not prepared to go on to middle school and to high school, and certainly not onto higher ed. Why isn't there more concern over this? Why isn't there an outcry saying, hey, half of our fourth graders are not reading at grade level? They're not, closer to 60% are failing when it comes to math outcomes. Why isn't there more outcry?
Yeah, it's a real shame. And as you said, it's a really critical issue because there's a lot of data that suggests that children who are not reading on grade level by the fourth grade statistically are highly unlikely to ever perform at grade level at any point in their educational career, which sets them behind for the rest of their lives in terms of multiple, outcome metrics. Sometimes educators want to make themselves feel better by recognizing that we've had stagnant student achievement in this state and in many other states for a great number of years. And when the outcomes are flat like that for a long time, you begin to look for other excuses as to why we're not making more progress. And one of the arguments that we want to hear is that we're not investing enough in education. If we just spent more on our public schools, they would do better. But in fact, Kentucky is spending a record amount of inflation-adjusted tax dollars in support of our schools, it may not be enough to satisfy some members of the education establishment, but it's simply not true that we have underfunded education. The Heritage Foundation recently did an analysis of educational efficiency, where they looked at the achievement outcomes based on the number of dollars that are spent per pupil in each state. And they did a ranking. It was sort of a bang for your buck sort of analysis. And what they found is that Kentucky is the 43rd state in the nation in terms of educational efficiency. We're one of the worst for getting good learning results for each education dollar that we spend. Whereas many other states that have school choice, including Tennessee, just to the south of us, do far better. Tennessee was ranked third in the nation in terms of educational efficiency, and they enjoy a number of different school choice policies there.
Gary, when you talk about education efficiencies, you mentioned bang for the buck, but are you looking, is that in relation to the outcomes? So in Tennessee, for example, they're being efficient with their dollars, and their kids are learning more. They're attaining better what they're learning in the classroom. They've got higher scores in math and in reading. Is that what you mean by the bang for the buck?
That's exactly right. And they do that with charter schools and a voucher program that enables low-income families to have other education options. So no evidence there that public education is being destroyed in Tennessee or other states.
Gary, you gave a presentation recently to a group of concerned citizens, parents, other interested groups down in Bowling Green, and you talked about choice, how this is something that we value and prize in our country. And when it comes to education choice, it's something that has been dismissed or somehow in a different category. Can you expand on that? I heard a little bit of your talk, but can you expand on that a little?
Sure. Yeah. I think the best way to illustrate this is to look at other forms of public investment where we recognize that the beneficiary deserves the option of choosing a provider. So, for example, We believe in this country that access to higher education is a public good, and therefore we have a federal Pell Grant program that enables low-income students to use tax dollars to attend any college or university that they can be admitted to, public or private, including faith-based. When it comes to healthcare, we do the same thing. We have Medicare and Medicaid because we believe that access to healthcare is a public good, but we honor the patient with the dignity of choosing their doctor or their hospital. And so we have all these other examples where we recognize that a public good that is very personal in terms of how it is delivered is one that the beneficiary should have some options in terms of how they access that. It's only in K-12 education that we systematically deny low and middle income families a choice that affluent families enjoy every day. So it's a fundamentally unjust situation.
Choice is certainly an American value. It's something that we prize. But unfortunately, there are those who don't think, as you mentioned, that parents and students should have a choice when it comes to education. The largest group in the Commonwealth of Kentucky opposed to Amendment 2 is called Protect Our Schools Kentucky. They're the leading opponents. They have the Kentucky Educators Association behind them, and there's national teachers unions behind them. I understand that it's in the millions of dollars that has been allocated so far. There's some projections that are saying it could be $10 million by the education establishment to defeat Amendment 2. Gary, you've alluded that it's not factual that school choice will hurt the public schools, but this is their strong argument. They're saying, look, if we have some kind of choice, it will hurt public schools. Particularly, and this is a point on their website, there's five reasons to vote against Amendment 2 that they say, but one of them is in particular, it will hurt, I'll quote from it directly. They use the word vouchers. We'll talk about that in a minute. Vouchers will negatively impact our rural public schools the most. So just talk about school choice in particular, then we'll unpack what they mean by vouchers.
That's certainly not been the case in other states. The Brookings Institute recently did a study that found that 59% of all children living in designated rural areas live within 10 miles of a private school option. And so it is not true that that rural families will have no benefit from school choice. Naturally, there are more private school options available in larger urban areas. There are also more public school options available in larger urban areas. But that does not mean that there aren't any available in rural communities. And therefore, rural families have a real distinct opportunity to benefit from it. And it's important to note, though, that the exact wording, the precise wording of Amendment 2 makes it clear that it does not change anything about Kentucky's current school funding mechanisms. And what that means is that the dollars that are set aside by the state to educate each pupil, it's called SEEK dollars, those cannot be used for any purpose other than for educating students in the public schools. And that's the plain wording of the Constitution and the previous court precedents and even the state law. Amendment 2 does nothing to change any of that. The funding for school choice under Amendment 2 would have to come from a separate line item in the biennial budget, the same way that a road project or a veterans hospital is funded. And no one suggests for a moment that road projects steal money from the public schools or veterans hospitals or anything else. So it's a disingenuous argument about what Amendment 2 does and how it affects public school funding.
We're going to take a quick break, but we'll be right back. Have you ever wondered why America is the most prosperous nation in history? We've certainly been blessed, but we take the conditions for prosperity for granted. That's why CPC is hosting the Toward a Better Bluegrass Conference. We've invited some of the top thinkers and leaders to speak about the sources of our economic strength. Biblical principles, America's founding framework, and individual capacity are a few issues that we'll be addressing. So please join us on October the 18th in Lexington. And for more information, go to our website, commonwealthpolicycenter.org, and we look forward to seeing you there. If you're just joining us, you are tuned into the Commonwealth Matters. I'm Richard Nelson, your host, talking with Gary Houchens about Amendment 2. Gary, Amendment 2 is on the ballot November the 5th. The opposition, Protect Our Schools Kentucky, is calling this, just before I broke in there, you mentioned that it's disingenuous to say that this is going to hurt public school funding because there needs to be enabling legislation to spell out what kind of particular choice will be allowed in Kentucky, whether it is a charter school or whether it is EOAs or vouchers. Now, they are calling this a voucher amendment. On the Protect Our School of Kentucky website, they say it four times as far as five reasons to vote against Amendment 2. They say this: vouchers divert critical resources away from public schools and instead send them to unaccountable private schools. I guess we'll start with there, respond to that. Do they divert critical resources away from public schools?
Well, no, Amendment 2 does not, as you noted, does not set up any program whatsoever. The state legislature will have to come back in a future session and decide what kind of school choice policy is best for Kentucky, whether that be charters or a voucher program or an education opportunities account, which has previously passed the state legislature. And so it's not, Amendment 2 does not set up a voucher or any other type of program. It merely states that the Constitution cannot be construed to prohibit such programs in the future.
So, Gary, are you saying that they're misleading on their website? I quoted verbatim what it says: five reasons to vote against Amendment 2, and then vouchers divert critical resources. Are they misleading?
They're absolutely misleading. They are using scare tactics to try to upset public school teachers and the general public and misinform them about what school choice is and how it actually works.
Thank you. And I wanted to spell this out very clearly because it's clear that they are misleading, that they are scaring teachers. I find this troubling that you would have teachers who, look, most of them are in it for the right reasons. Most of them are doing a good job, doing what they can do to educate our young people. But you have, I would say it's a special interest part of the education establishment that is doing all they can to defeat Amendment 2. Their concern is that the public schools are going to see a loss in resources. However, I've heard it explained this way, and nobody's talking about this, that if parents choose to take, if there was a voucher, which there's not, and it takes legislative action to enact them, and it's not even a given, Gary, you know this, the makeup of our state legislature is divided, even though it's controlled by Republicans. There is not consensus on whether or not vouchers are a good idea or good public policy. That's a whole nother battle. But there is this argument that it will take some money from public schools. But nobody's talking about if these parents choose to take their children out of the public schools, that is one less child that we will need resources for. Currently, I understand it is close to $20,000 per student in Kentucky to educate them. Is that a figure that you're familiar with?
Yes, that's approximately the combined dollars from state, local, and federal sources. So this is why school choice programs in other states typically have a positive effect on state budgets, because students who participate in school choice are typically educated at far less money per pupil than students in the traditional public schools. And so you actually wind up saving money in the coffers of the education system when students are educated elsewhere. You think about just the state allotment alone is on average $4,200 per student. That's adjusted from community to community based on the needs of students. But you think about a homeschooling family. Every homeschooling family saves the state $4,200 a year because they're educating their child at home. And those parents continue to pay their property taxes and their income taxes and support the public schools. And so what you get there is you get fewer, one less student in the public schools, but the exact same amount of local property tax dollars supporting the school. And that's why you have a net positive effect. You actually wind up with more dollars to spend on the students who are remain in the public school system.
And Gary, yet this is the strong argument by the teachers union. They're saying we're going to lose resources. Some have said, and they've jumped the shark on this, that it's going to destroy public education. Right? Destroy, that's pretty extreme. Are there any other states, though, where we've seen significant decrease in public school funding to the point where it's hurt the public schools, where they don't exist anymore?
Absolutely not. No, that is a falsehood. And in fact, if you look at other states, particularly the state of Florida, Florida is, you know, one of our largest states in terms of population. It has some of the oldest school choice policy mechanisms. Virtually every different kind of school choice is available in the state of Florida. And it has one of the highest levels of participation. And yet Florida's public school students outperform Kentucky's public school students across nearly every demographic variable. The other interesting thing about Florida is that, you know, there are about 3 million students in K-12 education in the state of Florida. Roughly half of those, 1.5 million, are attending a school other than their assigned public school. So lots of participation in school choice. And yet, 85% of all students educated in the state of Florida continue to be educated in traditional public schools. So what that tells you is that the public schools, even in a school choice rich environment, continue to enjoy public support. Parents want to send their kids, for a wide variety of reasons, to a public school. And so Florida has not seen any kind of mass exodus from their public schools because of school choice. But you do see families making choices on behalf of their children to select the school that is the best fit for them. Often it is a public school. So if the opponents of Amendment 2 were correct that school choice destroys public education, Florida should be a case study of that destruction. And in fact, it's just the opposite. Public education is thriving in the state of Florida, just as it will thrive in the state of Kentucky, even if we give families more options.
Yeah. Gary, is this because when parents have a choice, you have some kind of competition taking place? Is this school choice in Florida encouraged or prompted the public schools there to strive for another level of excellence? Is that what's happening there?
I think that's a reasonable speculation. I don't know that we can gather empirical data that proves that it is the competitive effect that has driven education improvement in Florida, but it certainly seems to make sense that when public schools recognize they no longer have a captive audience, that they actually have to appeal to parents and be the school of choice for parents, they will go out of their way to become more customer friendly and to pay more attention to students' learning environment and their outcome. That's the way competition functions in virtually every other sector of society. It makes sense that it would also function that way in education.
Again, going back to another one of their dishonest claims, again, this is from Protect Our Schools Kentucky from their website. They're saying vouchers mostly subsidize existing private school students. Speak to that.
Right. So this is a bit of a half-truth that they are looking at. What they look at is in states like Indiana, last year, the majority of the students who participated in school choice also attended a non-public school the previous year, but that's because those programs have existed for many years, right? Those programs are long-standing in states like Indiana. So certainly in any given year, a lot of the students who are participating also participated in the previous year. So it's a really misleading use of the numbers based on the families that are engaged. And the truth is that there are families who perhaps were sending their child to private school before they had the opportunity to participate in a program like this, but they were working multiple jobs. They were sacrificing their own retirement investments. They were going without health care because that it was that important to them that they be able to choose that school for their child. And that's a fundamentally unjust situation. No person should have to sacrifice their own retirement or health care in order to find a school that works for their kids, right? And so part of what school choice does is help families who are already making unreasonable sacrifices to exercise school choice in the first place.
Very good. And then finally, on their website, they say this amendment is another attempt to attack public education and undermine the backbone of our communities, our public schools. Is this an attack on public education?
Absolutely not. I mean, I'm approaching my 30th year working in the realm of education, and the vast majority of those years have been working directly or indirectly in support of our public school system. If I were a part of a conspiracy to destroy public education, then I've been going about it in a very odd way. For nearly three decades, right? The bottom line is that this is not about public schools or private schools. It's not about homeschools. It's about who should have the right and opportunity to choose a school for their child. And of course, it's parents. Parents are the ones who have that right. And I want every family to be able to exercise the same kinds of opportunities that I've been able to exercise for my children. I know most families will continue to choose a public school. We know that by the experience of other states, but it's not up for me to decide for another family the learning environment that's best for their kids. And that's what Amendment 2 does, is make sure every family has that opportunity.
Gary Houchins, man, it's been great to have you on the Commonwealth Matters. I don't know if you have a last word to say to somebody who might be confused or right on the don't know what to do when it comes to this Amendment 2, which again will be on the ballot Tuesday, November the 5th is Election Day. Early voting begins on Thursday, November the 1st. What final words of advice would you have for those parents or voters just not sure about this yet?
I think I would say, especially to parents or people who have been parents in the past, think about the choices you made for where your child was going to attend school, right? And if you made a choice, don't you believe that every family should also be able to make that choice, even if they don't have as much money as you? That's what Amendment 2 is about.
Okay, very good. Gary Houchins, thank you so much for joining us on the Commonwealth Matters.